Arpana Janaga was 24 when she died. To many of her friends and family, she's still frozen as she was in 2008. A daredevil motorcycle rider, a poet, a singer, a software engineer with a whole career, a whole life ahead of her.
Even today, when we had to make a tough decisions, we would be like, oh, what would Arpana do? What would Arpana think? What would she say?
To her two closest friends, Shri and Lalitha, Arpana is still very much present.
She is still part of our lives every single day. Every single day, I don't think me or Chandana forget about her. Even Chandana dream about her every month, that she's still alive. She constantly dreams about her.
Yes. Every few months, I get a dream. Like, she comes back saying, oh, I was just this at this place and nothing happened to me. I'm absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And this is the dream I've been having for all these few years. And I tell her that she will come back. I feel like that. That's how I wake up.
So she's there. I know it's been so many years, but she's there.
Shri and Lalitha prefer not to dwell on the grief. Instead, they remember Arpana as she was when she first moved into her apartment at the Valley View. Back then, she sounded happier than they'd ever heard her. Arpana was newly independent, and that little budget apartment complex on the outskirts of Redmond, Washington, was heaven on earth.
She said in an email that it's a little paradise, and she loved it.
Yes, she would share pictures like how it would look when it was drizzling outside, and Seattle is considered to be a beautiful place, and she would exactly say that, I feel like I'm in my paradise now.
Every day, I wonder what she'd be doing now.
Rachel Shout was one of the attendees of the Halloween party at the Valley View, and one of the last people to see Arpana alive. She thinks about Arpana all the time, too.
She'd have kids, if she'd be married. And I think about if we'd all still be friends and talking and everybody be happy still. She was one of a kind. But yeah, I do feel her all the time.
Arpana had a younger sister who's grown now. Pavitra wrote me an email not long ago. This world has lost a beautiful mind and a beautiful soul. Arpana believed there is good in everybody. Sadly, sometimes even when there was no good in them. I asked Pavitra, what do you make of the way the case ended? She wrote back, we expected justice to be served given how hard the prosecution worked and all the things they accomplished in terms of what can be included in the evidence. And most of all, we were looking for some kind of closure. Because no matter what happens, we cannot get her back. I never got to meet Arpana, but I have gotten to learn about her from her friends and family members like Pavitra. The moment I always come back to is her appearance on that TV show way back in 2005, where she'd come to talk about her award-winning invention and ended up singing a Bollywood love ballad for the host. Arpana, seated, her hair pulled back, wearing a red plaid dress, staring out into the middle distance, completely unaware of what's to come.
Ehsaan tera ho ga mujh par dil chahta hai jo kehne do mujhe tumse mohabbat ho gayi hai mujhe palkhon ki chhaon mein rehne do ehsaan tera ho ga mujh par.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From Campside Media and Wondery, I'm Matthew Scherr, and this is Suspect. This is the ninth and final episode, Haunted. Through 2020 and early 2021, the reporting team on this show interviewed close to 40 people directly connected to the investigation into Arpana's murder. Almost all of those sources, at some point in the interview process, confessed how much the case haunted them. All these years later, they found it nearly impossible to shake. The acquittal, unfortunately, made things even worse. Brian Coates, the detective, and Aaron Ellert, the prosecutor, were still sure Emmanuel was the killer, still sure they had the right guy. But after the acquittal came in June of 2019, plenty of other people involved in the story suddenly weren't. We trusted the cops when they said they had their guy. But now, after the trial, we're not so sure. I heard this from Arpana's friends. I heard it from her sister back in India. I heard it from Jay, the guy who discovered Arpana's body. Now, we're back to square one. Now, everyone is a suspect again. Last fall, I spent a few days looking for one of the attendees of the party, a guy who had testified at trial, but had more or less vanished afterwards. None of his old cell phone numbers worked. My emails bounced back. I finally found him via a cell phone number that was listed as being connected to his family business. He was angry I'd called, didn't want to talk on the record, didn't want me to use his name at all. But before he hung up on me, he said something interesting. Although he didn't know Emmanuel Fair, had met Emmanuel only once, in fact, he was sure Emmanuel hadn't killed Arpana. The next part's a direct quote, which I scribbled down as he was talking. All the doors to the Valley View were open that night, to all the hosts' apartments. If anyone really wants to know what happened, they'll start there, because I guarantee you this was someone who walked in off the street. He walked in, he walked out, and Emmanuel took the blame. Click. The idea that a stranger had killed Arpana was something I'd considered a couple times before. Once, when I visited the Valley View and noticed that Arpana's apartment was directly across a footbridge from the parking lot, the first door you'd encounter if entering the complex from the rear. And once when I read a document prepared by Emmanuel's attorneys in 2016. The document is called Defense Memorandum Regarding Other Suspect Evidence. It's a comprehensive analysis of the evidence in the Janaga case that did not point to Emmanuel. And honestly, it's a pretty staggering thing. In the memorandum, Ben Goldsmith is not trying to come to a conclusion about who killed Arpana. He's just highlighting and triple underlining with a Sharpie just how many questions have been left unanswered about other suspects, including two other men with lengthy criminal records. One of those strangers was a man named Israel Keyes, a serial killer and rapist who, the FBI has confirmed, was visiting the Seattle area on Halloween weekend of 2008. The other was an Army veteran named Mark Patrick O'Leary.
He was ultimately convicted or connected to at least six sexual assaults or attempted sexual assaults. Two were in Washington State in suburbs of Seattle, and the other four were in suburbs of Denver. The two that occurred in Seattle were in August of 2008 and in October of 2008. The assaults that occurred in Denver were in a 15-month period from late 2009 to early 2011.
Ken Armstrong is a Pulitzer-winning investigative journalist. In 2015, he co-authored an article about the hunt for O'Leary. The article later became the basis for a book and then a TV show called Unbelievable. I asked Ken to describe a bit about how O'Leary worked.
In terms of time and place, the case that you're looking at, it certainly fits. You know, he was living in Mount Lake Terrace, which is north of Seattle at that time. And the two assaults that he's been connected to in Seattle were shortly before this, right? I mean, one was a couple of months beforehand in August. The other was, I guess, 3 weeks beforehand. In both of the cases in Seattle, he used shoelaces from the victim to bind them.
Ligatures, like the one police suspected had been used on Arpana. And while O'Leary has never been linked to a murder, Armstrong suspects he hasn't confessed to everything he did.
The assaults they committed were so violent, even though in none of those six instances were the women killed. They were violent. There was a sadistic element to them.
Prosecutors have been the first to look into the possibility O'Leary had killed Arpana, but Ben went a step further. In 2015, he visited O'Leary in prison.
He was reluctant to talk to us initially. He thought that we were perhaps reporters, and so I assured him that I wasn't a reporter, but let him know that I was defending another client in a case, and I wanted to talk to him about his possible involvement in that.
Their conversation was terse and strained. O'Leary confirmed to Ben that he preferred to attack women in the early morning hours, when they were likely to be asleep or off their guard. Shockingly, he also admitted he had surveyed apartment complexes in Redmond in the fall of 2008. How many? Ben asked. O'Leary kind of shrugged. He had no idea. Anyway, he said, he had not killed Arpana Janaga. When Breanne Hughesby at the State Police Crime Lab had run samples from the crime scene against O'Leary's DNA profile, she had come up empty. Still, it's worth adding a couple of caveats here. O'Leary was exceedingly careful when it came to leaving traces of himself at crime scenes. And Breanne only tested evidence that she considered probative, meaning she thought it would help prove who had killed Arpana. Of course, what was considered probative and what wasn't was ultimately an educated guess. And in the end, that's true of so much of this investigation, as it's true of any case where no one has come forward and confessed to the crime. What's left is guesses, educated in a best-case scenario, not so educated in the worst. Stories, in other words, that everyone involved, prosecutors and defendants, forensic analysts or jurors, used to try to understand why and how. Jurors at Emanuel's trial heard two radically different stories. Emanuel murdered a stranger in cold blood, covered up the act like a professional criminal, and deserved a life sentence. Or Emanuel had nothing to do with Arpana's murder, was unfairly targeted by police and prosecutors on the strength of ambiguous DNA evidence, and should be set free. But Ben Goldsmith, the public defender who represented Emanuel, presents a third story, a third potential outcome.
I think like a truly honest, objective person looking at this case would say, I don't know what happened. I don't know who did this.
Ben's wearing a mask here, by the way. That's why he sounds the way he does.
I firmly believe Emanuel was innocent. But I guess I would have hoped that a law enforcement entity like the Redmond Police or the King County prosecutors would look at this case with the sort of objectivity and say, listen, this is a terrible crime committed against an innocent person. Arpana didn't deserve this. Nobody deserves this. But nobody deserves to be convicted of a crime they didn't commit. And looking at this evidence, if I were a prosecutor, I would hope, you know, I'd have the bravery to say, I'm sorry, I don't know who did this.
The defense memorandum regarding other suspect evidence is 43 pages long. plus thousands of additional pages of exhibits. And the bulk of it is not about possible strangers like O'Leary or Israel Keyes. It's an extended consideration of someone much closer to the victim. Cameron Johnson's statements contain many falsehoods and inconsistencies that are evidence of his consciousness of guilt, the document reads, and of his attempts to mislead investigators. There is, of course, the material that had come out at trial. Cameron's trip to Canada, his DNA at the crime scene, the search for a pawn shop in the days following the murder, or the misleading answers about when he called Arpana. There's also the fact that Cameron's BlackBerry was later scrubbed of call and text data. There was his despondent behavior around his family in the following weeks. And finally, there was a question the jurors heard about at the trial that Cameron had asked one of his best friends shortly after Arpana's body had been discovered. Could I have killed Arpana in my sleep? But the memo doesn't stop there. It includes more discoveries that jurors never heard. There's a witness interview, for example, from a friend of Cameron's who recalls watching Cameron punch walls, throw his cell phone through a door, and generally freak out, as one friend puts it. And there's an entry in Cameron's journal where he remembers getting suspicious that his girlfriend at the time had slept with a friend. He exploded at the woman, getting, quote, really loud. I got angrier and angrier. I don't remember much more except that I kicked a hole in her living room wall, which I patched later. I don't know if I was just reading into things too much. To be totally clear, none of this is evidence of guilt. But Cameron was the former lead suspect in Arpana's killing. He was someone that prosecutors and police officers, not just Emmanuel's defense attorneys, still openly discussed as being potentially involved. He was worth trying to talk to. I found Cameron's profile on Facebook and sent him a friend request, which he accepted. His profile showed he'd left Redmond for a small city about a 3-hour drive from Seattle. He was working as an engineer. In a lot of his pictures, he was smiling broadly, his dark hair cut close to the scalp. And so, last November, me and my co-reporters, Eric and Natalia, piled into an SUV and drove east out of Seattle on I-90, through North Bend and Tanner, and then over the Cascade Mountains to try and talk to Cameron.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a 1-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
Over there.
Yep. We arrived around lunchtime in front of the apartment complex that had shown up on public record searches for Cameron's name.
All right, so we're pulling up now. We're pulling basically off like a strip mall. There's like a long corridor of endless strip malls. And now we're crossing a set of rail tracks. It's kind of like weirdly industrial.
In the mountains, it had been snowing, but in Cameron's city was bright and clear. His truck, which he'd included in several photographs on Facebook, was not in the designated spot, and the windows of his unit, which faced the lot, looked dark. I rang the doorbell, but no one was home. We walked back down to the parking lot, got back in the car, and dialed Cameron's cell phone, which went to voicemail.
426 is not available.
Hey, Cameron. My name's Matt Scher. I'm a journalist. I'm actually here in... was hoping to talk to you about a project I'm working on about the murder of Arpana Janaga. Wanted to get your perspective on a few things.
Eric, Natalia, and I thought through our next steps. We could wait for Cameron to come back, although we might be waiting forever. We could try an address that appeared to be in the middle of an office park. Or we could try a third address that had popped up on a business registry. A house a little outside town. A house that was not owned by Cameron, according to the deed, or anyone with his last name. But hey, it was worth a shot.
Yeah, let's go there first. All right, let's go.
The house was a brown, low-slung ranch with a bunch of Christmas decorations out front. There was a black pickup truck parked in the driveway, the same one we'd seen on Cameron's Facebook.
Keys are in there tonight.
Natalia stayed in the car, and Eric and I walked to the door with Eric holding the mic.
First. Okay.
Inside, we could see kids' toys scattered across the floor. A young woman walked towards us.
Hey, how you doing?
Good,
we're looking for Cameron.
Yeah, let me go get him. Hang
okay,
on.
Sure.
Cam, someone's here for you.
A few seconds later, Cameron appeared. He kind of stood half in, half out of the house, with the door blocking his chest like a shield.
Hey, Cameron. My name's Matt Scher. I'm a journalist.
We're not going to play the full tape here, but I can summarize the discussion. I told Cameron that we were working on a podcast series about the murder of Arpana Janaga. Cameron, understandably, wanted to know how we'd found him, which I explained. I added that journalistically, ethically, it was important to have his perspective. He was polite, nice enough, but he was shaking, like tremoring. He told us he couldn't talk, that any question should go to his attorney. But as we lingered at the door, he said something else. He said, "It is the scariest thing that ever happened in my life. It literally pushed me apart." And then he slowly shut the door. In subsequent weeks, I sent a handful of emails to his lawyers asking for comment. Emails I know they received and discussed. They did not respond to a single one. Cameron Johnson may have moved away from the Seattle area, with little fear of running into anyone who has ever heard the name Arpana Janaga. But Emmanuel Fair, whose name and photograph had been plastered on the evening news for years, he was trying to restart his life in the place where he had always lived. I recently drove with Emmanuel to Volunteer Park in Seattle to meet with Ben Goldsmith. Ben had slipped out of his office between meetings and was waiting for us on the steps of the Asian Art Museum. The two men jogged towards each other, Emmanuel big and lumbering, Ben slim and medium height, his face covered by a surgical mask.
Yeah, man. I want to run and give you a hug, but it's corona, man. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? How you doing, man?
You look great. It's great to see you out here.
Yeah, man. It's good to see you too, man.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming, man.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. It's my attorney, Benjamin Goldsmith.
That's me.
Sir Ben. You know? Yeah, man.
You taking care of yourself?
Yeah, I'm trying, man. One step at a time. One day at a time.
We found a bench in the sunshine under a tree. Emmanuel stretched out, leaned back. A year, he recalled. A year since his release.
It's been a year.
I know. Catherine and I almost texted you on the anniversary, but we didn't,
You know what's crazy is I wasn't even paying attention to it. Then I looked at the calendar. I'm like, oh, wow. You know?
Yeah.
It's a whole year. You know? But it's good. It's good to be out, you know, moving forward.
Moving forward, though, requires thinking about what has happened.
You know? It's a lot of reflecting, thinking about all them bad days, you know what I'm saying? I just got an opportunity to have better ones. So that's important.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. You got to be a incredibly strong person to make it through what you've been through.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people say that, like, how are you not crazy and this and that? And, you know, I mean, reading, you know what I'm saying? That's what helped me. Reading, you know, I knew I was going to get out. I just didn't know how long it was going to take. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. When I think about Emmanuel's case, when I talk about it, I sometimes struggle to find the right terms. For a while, for example, I found myself mistakenly saying Emmanuel was exonerated because, well, that's what it felt like. But he wasn't exonerated because to be exonerated, you have to be convicted of a crime first. And Emmanuel never was. He was, according to our legal principles, always innocent, never a murderer. In that sense, maybe you can look at Emmanuel's case as a triumph of justice. He was appointed an exceedingly capable attorney who mounted a vigorous case that ultimately led to his acquittal. If that's what it was, though, a triumph of justice, well, it wasn't the kind of triumph of justice we sometimes see in movies or on TV. There was no last-minute discovery that a cop had planted evidence or that the DA was corrupt. It was a trial in the other sense of the word, a test. A series of events that tried the faith and patience and skill of nearly every figure it touched. And a series of events with precious few happy endings. At least not unqualified happy endings. For Ben Goldsmith, yeah, he had gotten his client acquitted. But that client still spent 9 years in a jail cell waiting to prove it. For Emmanuel, he's out. But his new present is shackled to the past. A few months after I hung out in the park with Emmanuel and Ben, I went back to Seattle one last time to spend a couple more days with Emmanuel. It was mid-autumn now. It felt like the stereotype of Seattle outside. Gray, rainy, with the hills cloaked in a low-hanging fog. But for Emmanuel, it seemed like a time of new beginnings, at least on the surface. He bought a car for the first time in his life. After a year of struggling to find employment, he had landed a job working security. He was thinking about getting an apartment of his own. Everything seemed to be coming together. But then that past would come creeping back into the present. Emmanuel would lie awake through the night. He was having trouble sleeping because of his asthma.
Sometimes I don't even sleep. You know, sometimes I get paranoid sometimes. And sometimes I hear people kicking on the, like, the jail cell doors and stuff, like in my sleep. And I wake up and I'm like, well, I'm at the house.
At times during our visit, Emmanuel was agitated. Something was bothering him. When we went back with him to his neighborhood, the Central District, he still felt like he did back in his gang days. Like he had to watch his back. Like someone was coming for him.
When we talked about why you didn't report, you said there were some neighborhoods that, like, you felt you were unsafe. Do you still feel that way?
Oh, yeah, I still feel that way right now.
Like where we are right now?
Even in my own neighborhood, yeah, I don't trust nobody.
The next day, he declined a call from an old friend. He said she had not visited the jail where he was being held. In fact, he hadn't heard from her for 9 years. Now, she was calling him. She wanted to get back into his life.
I got a whole bunch of friends that be calling me or on social media trying to hang out, and I'm not really into that, you know? I'm just not getting along with some of my coworkers, you know, at my job that I'm working, you know? And I just mind my business, man, and just do my job. I don't really say too much.
Because you feel like you can't trust them?
Yeah. I don't trust anybody. You know? No one.
The end of this visit was when I watched the walls Emmanuel keeps around himself crumble. Like, he could talk about emotion, talk about pain, talk about what he'd been through. He could do it for hours on end. And he did. But he'd always seemed detached from those feelings.
Does your outlook feel different now than it did 2 years ago, or a year ago, I guess?
Yeah, but, I mean, there's still no closure until there's justice. You know what I'm saying? There got to be some kind of justice for that family, you know? I mean, as of right now, my only justice is being out. I'm still not free. I'm just out. You know what I'm saying?
It hangs over you.
Right.
And can you, what if it hangs over you for the rest of your life?
I mean, then I'm going to be depressed for the rest of my life. You know? Simple as that. But, I mean, I still got to keep living. You know, I still got to keep moving. You know?
We put you through enough today.
Yeah.
Let's just sit here for 1 minute of silence.
At this point, Kyle, our field producer, he asked for a moment of silence to record the room tone. It's necessary for audio editing. Everyone else, we just sort of stared at our hands. But Emmanuel, he was crying.
I don't know. I feel like I'm gonna die soon. I mean, I don't know. Why? It's just, I don't know.
What makes you feel that?
Emmanuel remembered that his mom had died almost 2 decades ago on exactly the same day. Then he pointed to the car he just bought, his new driver's license.
I got this car in my name. I just feel like police could just run me and just, who knows what happened. Because it's just show up. That's what I got to live with, man, but it's all good, man. You know?
Eventually, he wiped his face. He was due at work in a few hours, the overnight shift.
You going to be all right tonight?
Yeah, I'm going to be all right.
We all sat there, not knowing quite what to do or say. Then Emmanuel flashed the barest hint of a smile.
You guys are making me nervous now.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Suspect ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Campside and Wondery, this is episode 9 of 9 of Suspect. Suspect was reported by Eric Benson, Natalia Winkleman, and me, Matthew Scher. Eric and I are producers. David Waters is the executive producer. Our editor is Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Field production by Kyle Norris. Aaliyah Papes and Callie Hitchcock are assistant producers. Fact-checking by Matthew Giles. Original music by Doug Slaywin and Netta Hadari. Consulting producers are Laura Ricciardi and Josie Duffy Rice. Our engineer is Jackie Sajiko. Mixing by Jackie Sajiko, Mark McAdam, and Garrett Tiedemann. Additional production assistance from Rod Sherwood. Studio engineer is Jimmy Guthrie at Arcade 160 Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. At Campside, the executive producers are me, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Josh Dean, and Adam Hoff. For Wondery, Chris Siegel is the producer. Production assistance from Fiona Pastana. Managing producer is Lata Pandya. Executive producers are George Lavender, Marshall Louie, and Jen Sargent.
You're about to hear a preview of Killer Psyche. While you're listening, make sure to follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen to new episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
I'm Candace DeLong. With a career spanning nearly 5 decades as a psychiatric nurse and FBI criminal profiler, I've sat across the table from hundreds of criminals and spent countless hours inside their minds. Now, in each episode of Killer Psyche, I'll unravel the psychology and motivation behind America's most complex and disturbing figures. Christopher Dunch was a malignant narcissist, and they are very skilled at getting other people to do what they want. Ted Kaczynski was a killer with a cause, and that's the most dangerous kind of killer. Not unusual for serial killers to try to make the police look bad. The DC sniper's message was, the police can't protect you. And they were right. I've spent my whole life learning about criminals, what they think and how they think. And now you will too. From Wondery, the company behind Dr. Death and The Apology Line, and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or to listen to episodes ad-free and 1 week early, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.